Coming up in this episode, nearly 2 decades since the end of the war, Liberia's children are still suffering.
Some of these men, they are evil. You look at 5-year-old baby, they saw you go rape that girl. It didn't have to be free.
In 2020, President Weah declared rape was an emergency. Now, 2022 is on track to see one of the highest number of reported cases in the last 5 years. The vast majority of the victims are under 18.
The whole issue around our justice system, not really enforcing the rape law, they're still continuing that act of rape.
Children are also struggling to get an education. We visit Weah says, 10 years on from our own major investigation into the state of schools there, and found the crisis continues.
Mama and my papa, but we are not going to school again. That may all be poor them.
And we hear from two internationally acclaimed investigative journalists from Nigeria about their passion for exposing the truth and their drive to do journalism that's useful to the audiences. This is our new podcast, Democracy in Focus. Welcome to our new program from New Narratives, looking at Liberia's governance and democracy, building in the run-up to next year's election. It's a collaboration of Frontpage Africa with reporting from some of Liberia's best reporters of the New Narratives program. I'm Anthony Stevens. A warning, some of the content of this program may not be appropriate for children. In 2020, as stories about the rape of children dominated the headlines of Liberia's newspapers, President George Weah declared a state of emergency. 2 years on, the latest data released by the Ministry of Gender suggests that 2022 is on track to be a bad year for rape, and especially for girls under 18. Senior New Narratives reporter Evelyn Kpadesikwi has been looking at the numbers for Frontpage Africa, and she joins me now. Evelyn, Liberia is not the only country with a problem of rape of children. I think for most of us, it's really difficult to even begin to understand. We decided to look into this problem of why men are raping children. What did you find?
Yes, Anthony. And some of us really struggle to understand why grown-up men keep raping children. It's something that I really don't like to talk about, but we just have to talk about it so that we can bring that to the spotlight. If we should stop child rape in Liberia, it's destructive to the lives of children and even families. The Ministry of Gender, Children and Social Protection 2022 first quarter report actually shows that this year, Liberia is on track for reporting high cases of gender-based violence, especially rape. I want to stress here that we do not know the true numbers of cases. Most people are still not reporting them. But on the other hand, there have been so many headlines, and I guess that is mainly because people are now having the awareness to report rape cases. But whatever the case, this year, honestly, the numbers are high. And what the numbers show is that the vast majority of rapes, 3 in every 4 victims are under the age of 18. So half are aged between 11 and 15. And 1 in every 5 victims is under the age of 10. Of course, rape has devastating consequences on the victims and even their parents. I spoke to a girl, let's call her Matu to protect her identity. She told me that she was allegedly gang raped on her 17th birthday. Matu said she actually felt betrayed by her male friend who masterminded her gang rape. And since that incident, her parents have tried tirelessly to ensure that those 3 alleged perpetrators be brought to justice. They've made follow-up at the police station where the incident happened in the community. There's been no trace of those alleged perpetrators. They are still on the run. Matu said the incident led to internal injuries on her, and she was taken to a local community clinic where she was treated. Matu's uncle has been really angry since the alleged rape of his niece, and we would prefer to keep his identity to protect him. The relentless numbers of rape cases in Liberia, for him, he said, is a silent war against Liberian children.
Some of these men, they are evil. You look at 5-year-old baby, then so you go rape that girl. It didn't have to be free.
That story is really hard to hear, especially for those of us who have daughters. You looked into this question of why it continues. What did you find?
There have been lots of theories around the issue of rape. Some you hear that this is mainly tied to the madness of the war, where people had this perception or the mindset that sleeping or raping children bring them luck. So that was completely rejected by Madame Gloria Yense, who is the program officer at Action Aid Liberia.
I'm kind of confused when they talk about having sex with a child bring luck. What kind of luck is that? So that's just cruelty. And that's the mind and perception the perpetrators carry off, of which we continue to see this on the increase from top to bottom.
You probably remember Anthony 2 years ago, after lots of headlines about child rape, the president declared a state of emergency, declaring rape as a national emergency, and then he allocated $2 million, particularly to help fast-track cases of rape and gender-based violence. And during that process, 2 DNA machines were provided by the government. And the mission of the DNA machine was to help fast-track alleged rape cases at the special court. And the government brought in those 2 DNA machines to collect samples from victims to help, you know, make cases against perpetrators. But unfortunately, 2 years on now, the DNA machines in the country are not working. The hospital told me that they are still waiting for some parts. 3 out of every 2 rape cases in Liberia, Anthony, are yet to make their way to court. Why 73% of GBV cases end up without result? Either the final rulings are delayed indefinitely, or survivors' family abandon their cases because of threats from perpetrators' family, you know, difficulty in getting witness testimonies, court delays, and a whole lot of challenges. That is exactly what's happening now with the case of Matu. Elizabeth Johnson is the country director for Action Aid Liberia. Experts say that as long as perpetrators face no consequences, rape will continue.
The whole issue around our justice system is not really enforcing the rape law. So you see, they're still continuing that act of rape.
I also spoke with the Assistant Minister for Children and Social Protection at the Ministry of Gender, Minister Maminaka Gay, who was clearly frustrated with the, you know, situation of rape. And she emphasized things the government is trying to do, but perhaps acknowledging the failures of the police and the courts, as well as hospitals, to do their part to stop this menace against Liberian children. She's also calling on families to work harder to stop rape.
Rape taking place in your home. Even if the Ministry of Gender will went ahead and employ another 1 million social workers, how will we deploy them? Will we deploy them in a Vera room? Until we can all get involved, we will not be able to prevent rape and we might not win this war against rape. This is time for us to hold hands together, and together we are able to win this war against rape.
How is Matu doing?
Matu continues to pay a heavy price. She suffers from trauma. She could no longer live in that very community where the incident happened. And because of that, she had to relocate. She and her family are still looking for justice, like many other families. Matthew's uncle said that his only prayer right now is to see his niece's alleged rapist pay for their crimes in court.
Thank you for your reporting, Evelyn.
You're welcome, Anthony.
Nearly 2 decades since the end of the war, Liberia's children are suffering in many ways too. Teacher shortages are leading many schools in rural states to close. It's a problem that experts say is playing out in rural areas across the country. Students, teachers, and parents say the problem is poor management by the Ministry of Education. Our senior correspondent Eric Obaduo is based in rural states. He has been reporting on the rural education crisis for Front Page Africa. Eric, please tell us more about what is going on.
Thank you, Antonio. My investigations found at least 5 schools that have closed in the last 2 years in the county because of teacher shortages. It could be many more. They are just the ones I have been able to visit to verify. There are about 400 kids with all access to primary education at the 5 schools I saw. But again, it is likely far more. Parents and teachers that I spoke to described the whole thing as a chaos where people who want to be teachers find it impossible to get on the payroll. When teachers leave, they continue to get salary and the ministry does not replace teachers when they leave. It is really impacting the students here. Many are discouraged and feeling bad. Jacob is now 15. He was in a fourth grade when his school Gemengble here in Kpokon closed down. His parents were too poor to send him to school, so he came here to live with his uncle.
Mama and my papa poor, that was our uncle to school to help them. But the way I'm not going to school again, that means I'll be poor at them.
Why is all this happening?
I did a story on ERBC Super Morning Show in December and found that 50 teachers had left Riverside's classrooms and were still being paid. Shortly after that story broke, Riverside County Education Officer Peter Nodi wrote the Director of Human Resources at the Ministry of Education to put a hold on the salaries of 50 teachers he claimed had abandoned the classroom but were still receiving salaries. All district education officers in the county were suspended for 1 month following an investigation launched by the Ministry of Education. Peter Nodi says the suspensions were triggered by the fact that the 50 teachers were still being paid. He says he held a meeting with the teachers who were being paid for not teaching in October last year and ordered them back to the classroom. Even among the schools that are still operating, some are barely functioning. For example, the Bowson Public School in Claw is one school that is operating with one teacher for 150 children. The school was closed from 2019 to 2021 when the teacher Jerome To was wrongly deleted from the payroll. He was unable to get the government to reinstate him, so he shut the school and left. But parents persuaded him to reopen in the latest school year, but he is still not being paid.
How has the community reacted to the decision to suspend the district education officers?
When the announcement was made, many residents and civil society actors in Riverside hailed the minister for that action. But the head of the Riverside branch of the Civil Society Council of Liberia, Simon Olen, is one of many critics who say in order to really improve the Riverside school system, the ministry should go further.
I'm not in support of the ministry's decision. 1 month is not sufficient. It should be 1 year or 6 months without pay.
There is not much confidence in the county that anything will be solved. People are calling on the government to get serious in addressing the problem, or another generation of Liberian kids are going to go without the benefits of a decent education.
Thank you for your reporting, Eric.
I'm honored, Anthony, to be a part of this podcast.
We at New Narratives have been pleased to take on 16 new reporters from leading newsrooms across the country this week for new projects supporting investigative journalism in governance and democracy and the many challenges we Liberians face. We will hear from many of them in coming programs. To kick things off, we brought in leading investigative journalists to share their techniques and offer advice on how to play their democratic role of informing the public and holding leaders to account. First, we will hear from Rauna Meyer, who is the Africa lead for the Solutions Journalism Network, a U.S. organization that's helping journalists think through how their journalism can be most helpful to audiences. Rauna has won numerous awards for her journalism, but her family has also paid a heavy price for telling the truth. Rauna's father, Gwawin Awoko, was jailed and finally assassinated in Nigeria in 2006 for his political journalism. Our apologies for the poor quality of this recording. Rauna, welcome to this interview.
Thank you very much.
How has it been in Liberia?
It has been really amazing. The people, the attendees, were really forward-thinking. The food was even better. I had a great time teaching and learning as well. We had a great bunch of attendees, and we had twice the volume of stories that will be investigated over the course of the next few months. So I'm excited about that, and I'm excited about what it means for the media landscape in Liberia.
Tell us a little bit about what you do.
So I'm Africa Initiative Manager at the Solutions Journalism Network. That's an NGO based in New York. But the Africa Initiative of SJN covers 4 countries and 60 newsrooms. So we're in Nigeria, we're in Rwanda, Uganda, and Kenya. And what we do is teach the methods of solutions journalism. That's an approach for all beats. And solutions journalism is basically evidence-based reporting, emphasis on the evidence, evidence-based reporting of responses to social problems. We're not saying it's about feel-good news, no, we're saying it's about showing the whole picture. So when you report on responses to problems, you situate the problems constructively and you remove the excuses from those who say this problem is unsolvable.
You did mention earlier that you did interact with the journalists, very promising journalists.
Yes.
What did you teach them during the course of the 3 days?
Oh, I like to think, what did we exchange? Because I learned a lot as well about media practice in Liberia from the colleagues. Mainly, it was about how to look at problem-focused reports and get out solutions that can be investigated. Every single agency or country, every agency in every country, often every government has solutions, policy responses. So it's about investigating the context of these responses, these policies, at government level, at community level, because we went on the field as well to talk to everyday people. It's about investigating the responses to the general problems and trying to explain when necessary, trying to expose when necessary, with the view of giving wholesome journalism that can make people take action in the right direction. I have to say, I've taught for more than a year and a half in solutions journalism, and it was very enlightening to see these attendees really take it up immediately. It was almost as if they already knew about solutions journalism. It's really about changing that mindset and seeing that there's an added weapon to sharpen your journalism, whatever beat you are on, and that's the solutions journalism approach.
Is it a different form of journalism?
No, it's not. We only have a label because we have to be clear what we're talking about. It's a solutions approach to all types of journalism. So we've trained people who report on women, who report on the justice system in Ethiopia, to use that approach. We recently worked with the United Nations Environment Programme for women in East and Central Africa. So it's an approach for all beats and for all journalists.
Is this a critical form of reporting as well?
It is very critical because it criticizes the responses to problems. It criticizes people who are supposed to be held accountable. It takes the evidence and actually holds it up to scrutiny. It actually compares what is happening in a place versus what is happening elsewhere. And it is investigative. There's even research that shows that solutions journalism and investigative journalism approaches are almost the same. So this is why I say, and we say, it is not something that is a special type of journalism.
So there's no major difference between solutions journalism and investigative journalism?
No, there's no major difference because they all interrogate things. The only difference, they all expose things, they all unearth new information, they interrogate data. The only difference is that solutions journalism will be looking at a response to a social problem, but it will be investigating that response, it will be giving context, it will be even explanatory journalism, it will be accountability journalism as well, once it's done properly.
And before we leave you, how are you going to use your knowledge, use your expertise working with the journalists here? Because somebody could say 3 days may not be enough to teach somebody who doesn't have the basic about solutions journalism or about solutions journalism.
Exactly, that's a very good question. Solutions journalism, I like to call it a muscle. You have to exercise it every day to get into the practice. That's what we notice in places like Rwanda, where we introduced solutions journalism for the first time. I'm quite intrigued by what New Narratives is doing because they didn't just say, let's get some training and then goodbye. I will still be working closely with the journalists, the colleagues here. And apart from that, the thing about a solution journalism training is you are part of the network. You end up being part of the network because we have things like our story tracker, which has thousands of stories from hundreds of newsrooms all over the world. And when solution stories are done, they are put in the tracker to show everyone what the form looks like, to encourage or inspire people who are wondering what solutions journalism looks like. Once you're in our network, you never leave our network. And I'm glad that New Narratives also has that approach. So we'll continue to provide support as long as the colleagues say they need it.
Just one personal question. You are also pursuing a PhD. All journalism, all your degrees have been...
All my degrees.
About journalism.
Yes.
Why?
Because I think that's the only thing I knew how to do. I mean, I first went to school for microbiology and I failed. I failed totally. But once I started doing my first degree, second degree, and now my PhD in journalism, it's the only thing I'm good at. So I'm sticking with it because journalism can be rewarding. When it's done right, when it's done with the public in mind, it can be rewarding and I'm a product of that. So I don't think I'm good at anything else. So I will be sticking to journalism, Anthony.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you too, Anthony. Long live New Narratives.
As part of our training, we also brought in one of Africa's most awarded investigative journalists, Idris Akinbajo, who is the managing editor of the leading Nigerian newsroom, Premier Times. Idris talked to Liberian media bosses about the need to reach broad and diverse audiences with engaging journalism that was useful to them.
You were originally a journalist, you were an engineer. What drove you to journalism?
Passion, I would say, passion. Even when I was in school studying food technology, I was the campus journalist.
Now, you are an award-winning Nigerian journalist, several awards. I've been reading some of your articles, including the one that won you an award in 2012, the one about corruption in the education sector. What does it normally take you to do these kinds of stories?
First is the fact that I try to look out for sectors that are not working, either because of corruption or regulatory failures. And so I ask myself, why is this case? So in that particular story, for example, there's been this incessant clashes between farmers and herders. It's been on for decades in Nigeria. And so I ask myself, has the government ever thought about any action to stop this? And I realized that the Nigerian government actually put in place what we call a National Commission for Nomadic Education. That was supposed to be an agency that would ensure that nomads, cattle herders, while they are moving from one place to the other, still get educated. But that's not the case. What was happening? So I decided to investigate, and that led to the production of that story.
And normally these kinds of investigative pieces do lead to a lot of things. They do make people to sometimes lose their jobs. Do you feel happy when people lose their jobs in these kinds of, as a result of these kinds of investigations?
If the corrupt people lose their jobs, I'm always happy. But there's been at least one case where somebody was not deserving of losing a job, lost a job, and I really felt bad.
Was there a time that you did an investigation but nothing happened?
Majority of times, nothing happens when we do investigations. Either me as the reporter then or now as an editor at Premier Times. Majority of times, nothing happens. I have come to realize that as a journalist, you just keep doing your work. Don't get bothered about it. But sometimes you see reporters who are downcast, and say, editor, I've been writing, no, but they are not doing anything about it. Don't give up.
How do you stay safe? Doing these kinds of investigations, sometimes you face threats. How do you stay safe doing these kinds of investigations?
One is that, for me, I believe, because I'm on the right track, I'm not corruptly enriching myself, and I'm only doing it for the benefit of the society, I'm not scared of anything. That's one. Two is that I try to be as anonymous as possible. And so I've had so many people say, you don't have pictures on the internet. Why come it's only your old pictures? For me, it's deliberate. There is no reason for me to make everybody that sees me know that's the guy running Premium Times. Why do I want to do so? In fact, when I was a reporter, I've been to places to observe people speaking, people in power, they'll say, there's nobody bearing injuries at Next. They're just using that name to publish all these their wicked stories. Because they didn't know who I was. So for me, anonymity is a key. Unfortunately now, because of social media, you probably see a few of my pictures online. But I try to remain as anonymous as possible. I try to avoid being the story. So that's one of the ways I try to. And then I'm a Muslim, so I pray a lot to God. So my anonymity is not about the articles or my byline. It's about my face, what I look like, my family members, what my wife does, what the schools my children go to, what they look like. I try to keep those sources as private as possible.
What have you learned about journalism in your career?
I think journalism can be a tool for good or for evil. It can be a tool to either develop democracy, promote democracy, or weaken democracy. I mean, look at the American experience. The role Fox News, for example, plays in making the US what it is now cannot be emphasized, but it's a media platform. And the role the media in developing countries, Nigeria, Liberia, are doing to hold power accountable shows that journalism can be a force for good. It can also be a force for evil.
Is there any other thing you want to say before we leave you?
I think one of the things that I'm personally concerned about in journalism is the ethics of it. I think the media in Nigeria, the media in West Africa, the media in Africa are not doing enough to address the unethical issues in the media. It really bothers me when I see the kind of corruption that exists in the media in Nigeria, in Ghana, and the rest. And there needs to be a lot more discussion about ethics in the West African media landscape.
That's a very key point. I know I say it was the last question, but ethics is very key. How can this be addressed? All of these issues, how can they be addressed?
First, it must be discussed. In Nigeria, they have there's this proverb that it's a Yoruba proverb, essentially that says, don't expose yourselves. So I think there is a deliberate culture of silence in the media not to discuss the corruption within the media. The media houses don't report the corruption in that media houses. Journalists don't report the corruption by other journalists and the rest. And I think that is a significant part of the problem. There needs to be discussion around it. There needs to be reporting around it.
Adrian, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
In our next program, we will explore the raging battles over land rights in Liberia's forests, and we meet more Liberians working on solutions. You are listening to Democracy in Focus, a New Narratives production. If you have a story suggestion or want to let us know what you think of the program, text us at WhatsApp number +231 770 960 297. You can also comment and follow us on Facebook at New Narratives or check out our website at newnarratives.org. I'm Anthony Stevens. The music in this episode is by Faith Vonek. This podcast is funded by the Swedish and US embassies in Liberia. Thanks for listening.